Late 1944, a number of scientists at Los Alamos began to voice their growing ethical qualms about the continued development of the gadget. Robert Wilson, now chief of the lab's experimental physics division, had quite long discussions with Oppie about how it might be used. Snow was still on the ground when Wilson went to Oppenheimer and proposed holding a formal meeting to discuss the matter more fully. "He tried to talk me out of it," Wilson later recalled, saying I would get into trouble with the G2, the security people. Despite his respect, even reverence for Oppie, Wilson thought little of this argument. He told himself, "All right, so what? I mean, if you're a good pacifist, then clearly you are not going to be worried about being thrown in jail or whatever they would do, have your salary reduced or horrible things like that." So Wilson told Oppenheimer that he hadn't talked him out of at least having an open discussion about an issue that was obviously of great importance. Wilson then put up notices all over the lab announcing a public meeting to discuss the impact of the gadget on civilization. He chose this title because earlier, at Princeton, just before we'd come out, there'd been many sanctimonious talks about the impact of something else, with all very scholarly kinds of discussions. To his surprise, Oppie showed up on the appointed evening and listened to the discussion. Wilson later thought about 20 people attended, including such senior physicists as Vicky Weisskopf. The meeting was held in the same building that housed the cyclotron. "I can remember," Wilson said, "it being very cold in our building. We did have a pretty intense discussion of why it was that we were continuing to make a bomb after the war had been virtually won." This may not have been the only occasion when the morality and politics of the atomic bomb were discussed. A young physicist working on implosion techniques, Louis Rosen, remembered a packed daytime colloquium held in the old theater. Oppenheimer was the speaker, and according to Rosen, the topic was whether the country is doing the right thing in using this weapon on real live human beings. Oppenheimer apparently argued that as scientists they had no right to a louder voice in determining the gadget's fate than any other citizen. "He was a very eloquent and persuasive guy," Rosen said. The chemist, Joseph O. Hirschfelder, recalled a similar discussion held in Los Alamos' small wooden chapel in the midst of a thunderstorm on a cold Sunday evening in early 1945. On this occasion, Oppenheimer argued with his usual eloquence that, although they were all destined to live in perpetual fear, the bomb might also end all war. Such a hope, echoing Bohr's words, was persuasive to many of the assembled scientists. No official records were kept of these sensitive discussions, so memories prevail. Robert Wilson's account is the most vivid, and those who knew Wilson always thought him a man of singular integrity. Victor Weisskopf later recalled having political discussions about the bomb at various times with Willie Higginbotham, Robert Wilson, Hans Bethe, David Hawkins, Phil Morrison, and William Woodward, among others. Weisskopf recalled that the expected end of the war in Europe caused us to think more about the future of the world after the war. At first, they simply met in their apartments and pondered questions such as, "What will this terrible weapon do to this world? Are we doing something good? Something bad? Should we not worry about how it will be applied?" Gradually, these informal discussions became formal meetings. "We tried to organize meetings in some of the lecture rooms," Weisskopf said. "And then we ran into opposition. Oppenheimer was against that. He said that's not our task, and this is politics, and we should not do this." Weisskopf recalled a meeting in March 1945, attended by 40 scientists, to discuss the atomic bomb in world politics. Oppenheimer again tried to discourage people from attending. "He thought we should not get involved in questions about the use of the bomb." But, contrary to Wilson's memory, Weisskopf later wrote that the thought of quitting did not even cross my mind. Wilson believed it would have reflected badly on Oppenheimer if he had chosen not to appear. "You know, you're the director, a little bit like a general. Sometimes you have got to be in front of your troops, sometimes you've got to be in back of them. Anyway, he came and he had very cogent arguments that convinced me." Wilson wanted to be convinced. Now that it seemed so clear that the gadget would not be used on the Germans, he and many others in the room had doubts but no answers. "I thought we were fighting the Nazis," Wilson said. "Not the Japanese particularly." No one thought the Japanese had a bomb program. When Oppenheimer took the floor and began speaking in his soft voice, everyone listened in absolute silence. Wilson recalled that Oppenheimer dominated the discussion. His main argument essentially drew on Niels Bohr's vision of openness. The war, he argued, should not end without the world knowing about this primordial new weapon. The worst outcome would be if the gadget remained a military secret. If that happened, then the next war would almost certainly be fought with atomic weapons. They had to forge ahead, he explained, to the point where the gadget could be tested. He pointed out that the new United Nations was scheduled to hold its inaugural meeting in April 1945, and that it was important that the delegates begin their deliberations on the post-war world with the knowledge that mankind had invented these weapons of mass destruction. "I thought that was a very good argument," said Wilson. For some time now, Bohr and Oppenheimer himself had talked about how the gadget was going to change the world. The scientists knew that the gadget was going to force a redefinition of the whole notion of national sovereignty. They had faith in Franklin Roosevelt and believed that he was setting up the United Nations precisely to address this conundrum. As Wilson put it, "There would be areas in which there would be no sovereignty. The sovereignty would exist in the United Nations. It was to be the end of war as we knew it, and this was a promise that was made. That is why I could continue on that project." Oppenheimer had prevailed, to no one's surprise, by articulating the argument that the war could not end without the world knowing the terrible secret of Los Alamos. It was a defining moment for everyone. The logic, Bohr's logic, was particularly compelling to Oppenheimer's fellow scientists. But so too was the charismatic man who stood before them. As Wilson recalled that moment, "My feeling about Oppenheimer was, at that time, that this was a man who was angelic, true and honest, and he could do no wrong. I believed in him."